I wanna be a billionaire so freaking bad. Buy all of the things I never had.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of December 24th, 2010. Today, you loved it so much the first time, our gift to you this holiday season is an encore presentation of our special report on what it takes and what it means to be rich.
A household of $250,000 is not wealthy.
The definition of rich changes depending on where you are. I mean, by the standards of most of the world, just about every American is rich.
$250,000 is enough for you to do whatever it is that you need to do.
I think it really depends on what kind of lifestyle you want to have to be wealthy.
If your neighbors are putting in $10,000 refrigerators and $15,000 washing machines and dryers, $250,000 would seem like that's not a lot of money.
They've heard of Bill Gates and they know about Oprah, but very few Americans actually even know anybody is that rich.
In an ideal world, the holiday season is not about money. It's about all the other things that make us rich: family, friends, the comforts of home. But the question of how much money makes us rich took center stage in the fight over tax cuts, and whether having an adjusted gross income of $250,000 and up means you are wealthy. We produced a special hour-long report on this question in October, and today we're reprising that hour with a special twist at the end. First, we went to five cities across the country and asked, simply, does $250,000 make you rich?
$250,000 a year is definitely wealthy because I know a lot of people who are getting by on $15,000 to $25,000 a year.
If I made $250,000 a year, I think that I could do a whole lot.
$250,000 is enough for you to do whatever it is that you need to do within a household if you're living within your means. And if you can't manage $250,000, I want to know what's wrong with you.
It's probably not anymore.
A household income of $250,000 in New York is right around average.
No, I don't consider a household income of $250,000 a year as wealthy.
$250,000 a year is pretty decent.
A household of $250,000 is not wealthy.
Not enormously wealthy, but
certainly a lot more money than the average American family.
I do not believe so.
Yes, in many places in the country it is.
No, I do not think that $250,000 a year is actually wealthy.
That's a lot of money, and I'm pretty sure you can manage that if you manage it right.
No. Wealth to me is someone that makes over $500,000 a year.
In most parts of the country and most parts of the world, absolutely.
I think it's a wealthy income. I think someone can maintain, you know, way of living with $250,000.
Not in New York City.
That's a pretty good chunk of change.
Currently, I make $12,000 a year, so $250,000 per year, I don't know what I would do with that much money.
Now, let's clarify a couple of things. First, when politicians were batting around the $250,000 figure, they were talking about what's left after deductions. Second, we are not talking about money and happiness here, just money and how much of it makes you wealthy. Of course, by using that word, I'm throwing a wrench into things because there's well-off, there's wealthy, and then there's rich.
Ben Franklin said he asked the question, who's rich? And he answered that by saying, he who is content. And then he asked the question, who's that? And he said, nobody.
That's Ted Klontz. He's a financial psychologist and author of Mind Over Money. Through today's show, we'll be hearing from him and from Robert Frank, who writes the Wealth Report blog for The Wall Street Journal. We started with Frank, and the question, is $250,000 rich?
No. If you look at the statistics in America, it would make them rich on a national basis. But relative to peer groups, relative to what true wealth is in America, no.
Ted Klontz?
Well, I think if people measure their wealth in terms of dollars, probably not, and they probably will never have enough dollars.
Well, let's get to the question of relativity, which, Mr. Frank, you brought up. And this really is a question of perception, I think. According to census data in 2008, and I'm going to credit Dan Gross over at Slate for compiling this, median household income nationwide was just over $50,000. And as he pointed out, even in the wealthiest areas of the country, San Francisco at $74,000 median income, New York Metro $61,000, 250 is way above all of those. How does anyone argue that $250,000 a year is somehow middle class, Mr. Frank?
I think it really depends on what kinds of things you want to buy and what kind of lifestyle you want to have to be, quote, comfortable or to be wealthy. In New York City, if you want to send your kids to private school, if you want to own a car, if you want to own an apartment larger than 400 square feet, all of those things require income probably in the $500,000 or more category. Now, if you lived in Omaha, Nebraska or South Dakota, $250,000, $300,000 is very comfortable and probably wealthy. So it's not so much relative to peers, but relative to the costs of where you live.
Well, this is Ted, and one of the concepts that we talk about is something we call relative deprivation. And it's a sense that people have a judgment of whether they're wealthy or poor based on who they hang around. You know, there was a Harvard study done not too long ago where students were asked, would you rather make $50,000 while your peers make $25,000 or $100,000 while your peers make $200,000? And the majority of the students chose $50,000.
But when we're talking about government policy, why should those kinds of external influences, you know, I don't feel rich, play a part in that? Shouldn't that be very dispassionate and realistic based on the numbers?
One of the pitfalls of what's happened with the discussion of wealth in America today is that it's become very politicized and I think misrepresented by both the left and right. Look, the government needs money right now for lots of things, for health care, for the deficit. The states need money. I think the term rich, the term wealthy has been applied with numbers really to make it politically sellable to voters. And I think that's really distorted the debate.
Robert Frank and Ted Klontz. We'll hear more from them later in the show. Robert Frank noted that politics has distorted the debate over what makes you rich, but perceptions play a big role, too. You'll remember F. Scott Fitzgerald's line about the rich being different from you and me, and that applies to how they perceive their own wealth. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our story.
Hi. Hi. This dog is very friendly. Do you mind?
He's no.
Terrible manners. We give
Thayer Cheatham Willis, unlike her dog, has impeccable manners to match her impeccably decorated Tudor home in the exclusive Portland suburb of Lake Oswego. She's an heir to the Georgia Pacific lumber fortune and a counselor to the rich, psychological, not financial. She wrote a book, Navigating the Dark Side of Wealth, which she admits is a bit precious.
Like, give me that problem. I mean, that's a problem.
But in fact, she's seen a lot of depression, isolation, and failure come along with a big inheritance.
I saw so many of my peers struggle and so many tragic endings.
Willis says those who inherit often live with deep doubt and insecurity about their so-called friends.
How do I know if people like me for me?
And not for the money.
Is it always you who pays for coffee when you go out for coffee? Or do they pay half the time? You pay attention to those little things.
Sometimes, though, friends don't know you have old money. It's kept under wraps, so inheritors don't even know how rich they are.
Basically, when I got to age 16, they said, by the way, that mill where your grandfather works is owned by our family and has been for generations.
Mike Lapham grew up what he thought was solidly middle class in Rochester, New York.
Came as a surprise that I was going to get dividends, and somewhere along the line they said, you know, you might have enough money that you wouldn't have to work. It was an adjustment, let's say, you know, to go from thinking that you're just like everyone else.
Lapham now works for a group, Responsible Wealth, that enlists rich people to support progressive causes. But he learned from his parents to keep quiet about his money.
I think some do's and some don't messages, you know, don't tell anyone because they'll treat you differently. Don't show that you have wealth. Certainly don't spend it.
This is common in families anxious not to squander what's left of their fortune, says Thayer Willis.
Inheritors have less conspicuous conception, and that sometimes is from not having the confidence that they could recreate that fortune. Whereas successful entrepreneurs often have the confidence, well, I did it once, I could do it again.
Kristen Hull learned that lesson from her father. Blair Hull built a phenomenally successful trading firm that sold to Goldman Sachs for $500 million. But when Kristen Hull was a kid, they lived on food stamps.
He also managed apartments so that we could live there for free.
Now, Hull works as an educator and for the Family Foundation. The family investments help support her lifestyle in the Oakland Hills, but
I grew up without it, and so I know that I don't need it. I'm confident in my ability to earn my own living.
Still, she's wary of letting people know how wealthy her family is.
You know, it really matters, and it can be really scary to be in new relationships, new friendships, and wonder what people are thinking.
Donna Hill Wiley of Houston isn't worried about what other people will think of her wealth. She barely knows what to make of it herself.
I never honestly thought that we would inherit much of anything, perhaps a house. I never, ever expected anything like this.
This is more than $1 million from the estate of her parents, African-American professionals who'd invested prudently. She had high hopes
that I would be able to follow a couple of dreams I'd always had, to go to art school, maybe to start a business, you know, purchase my husband and I some investment property.
But the economy had other ideas. Soon she and her husband, a draftsman, were both unemployed, and Hill Wiley has diabetes. Now they're living off their inheritance, which doesn't sit well.
We in America love the idea of earning your money. When someone leaves it to you, somehow it just doesn't have the same glamour. You feel guilty, for one thing, because someone died for you to be in the position you're in.
But spending it does have a certain thrill, like the time they got turned down for a car loan because of being unemployed, even with $1 million in assets.
I pulled out a checkbook and I wrote a check for a car. That's something I've dreamed about doing pretty much my whole life. Would I describe myself as wealthy, heiress? I would not. Bag lady fears are, you know, I have those fears just like everyone else. $1 million is not what it used to be. We lost two incomes. We pay terrible health care premiums. What I think wealth has done for us is shield us from a lot of that. To me, that is wealth.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. One common theme in the comments we've received from you about this subject is that the question of whether $250,000 makes you rich depends entirely on where you live. We decided to test that theory across a 6-mile span of Los Angeles. You are no doubt familiar with Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. You may not be as familiar with Rodeo Road in South L.A. Michael Stoll is our tour guide for both. He teaches public policy at UCLA. We met up at the corner of Wilshire Boulevard and Rodeo Drive.
So let me do a little description for folks who have not been here. We're standing at the corner of not just Rodeo and Wilshire, but at the corner of Tiffany and Vuitton and Jimmy Choo. So let's talk a little bit about what $250,000 means in this kind of culture.
$250,000 means in this part of town that you're still at the top 2% of the income distribution in the United States, and you're only slightly higher than the average family income in Beverly Hills. The average family income in Beverly Hills is about $225,000. $250,000 would just mean that you are a member of the community. I think most people here would argue that they are not poor. Some would argue that they were rich, and some would argue that they are middle class. The way we think about income is in two different ways. One is an absolute interpretation of income, and the other is a relative. And if you're thinking about income relative, which means you're comparing yourself to your neighbors or some other kind of reference point, if your neighbors are putting in $10,000 refrigerators and $15,000 washing machines and dryers, $250,000 would seem like that's not a lot of money, particularly if you're trying to meet a certain level of living. But on an absolute basis, if we look at the median income of the United States, which is about $55,000, $59,000 a year, $250,000 is a lot of income.
And isn't it also a lot about the choices that you make? For example, in Manhattan, if you decide to get an apartment near Central Park, if you decide to send your children to private school, those are decisions that you're making. That's not necessarily what you have to do to live there.
That's correct. And what typically happens, though, is that the demand usually meets the supply. So if your income raises up to $250,000 or $300,000, more than likely your spending habits also rise to meet that income threshold too. So most families would always say that they are squeezed, but you have to ask the question again, you know, what is it that is required to have a decent standard of living in the United States? And if we were to have some absolute notion of what that is, I think it would still be fair to say that even in Beverly Hills, that $250,000 would provide for a lot of comfortable living.
Well, let's talk about how we do define those absolutes. What do you think people think about when they consider what qualifies you as wealthy? What do you have?
Right. One way to think about it is to think about how the federal government defines what is an adequate standard of living. And the way that we do that is through the poverty line.
Right.
And the federal poverty line now for a family of four is somewhere around $25,000 a year. So most people who think about absolute sources of income would say, well, somewhere around there. Others would say, well, what is the median income in the United States? Again, it's about $55,000 to $59,000 a year. You know, that's certainly much lower than the $250,000 thresholds.
Well, I think we've had enough here on beautiful Rodeo Drive. Shall we head to another part of town that might paint a whole different picture for $250,000?
Yes.
All right, we'll see you there. Well, Michael, we are now in our new location at the corner of
Rodeo Road and Crenshaw Boulevard in Leimert Park.
Tell us about this part of town.
This part of town is considered South Los Angeles. If you look at the average income in the immediate neighborhoods around here, people earn on average about $45,000 to $50,000 a year, so it puts them really close to the national average for income in the United States. The homes around here go for significantly less than in Beverly Hills. The average house in Beverly Hills is list price is about $2.1 million. And here the average list price is somewhere around $400,000, $450,000. The housing here is not quote-unquote cheap, but it is significantly less than what we observed in Beverly Hills.
Now, you have a bit of an attachment to this neighborhood.
Yeah, coincidentally, I was raised right around the corner, so I've seen this area come and go through its ups and downs in the early 1980s and 1990s. This area had a very high crime rate during that time, but has since seen a little bit of a renaissance because of its nice location in between the beach and downtown L.A. So this area is on a slight uptick. But again, if we were to think about that $250,000 line, it's very unlikely that anyone in this neighborhood would be earning that. And most people who would think about that would know that their standard of living would raise about five times its current level. And if you were to say that we would add five times the income to your current income, most people would say, that'll be great, I'll be rich.
Any final thoughts as we leave Rodeo Road and our previous visit to Rodeo Drive? And again, it's kind of magic number, $250,000.
$250,000 a year. And remember, we just drove 6 miles. There is a noticeable physical difference in the neighborhoods and in the shopping quality and the stores that are available to consumers in these areas. Yet, this area represents the average income distribution in the United States. So we're standing in the typical American neighborhood. If we were to go 10 miles to the east and go into an area that has an average income of about $18,000, $20,000, it would be significantly different. And there, the difference between what people would interpret as $250,000 and whether or not it's considered wealthy or just making ends meet, I think people would even have a hard time listening to reporters or academics talk about the struggles of the people at the $250,000 level. I think that would be even more laughable argument to make.
Well, Michael Stoll, professor and chair of public policy in the School of Public Affairs at UCLA, thanks so much for traveling around town with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
We've got pictures of our visit to those two streets. Check out photos at marketplace.org. Earlier this year, a University of Chicago professor, Todd Henderson, wrote a blog post titled, "We Are the Super Rich." His argument was that he actually isn't, despite a household income, his wife is a doctor, of more than $300,000. He complained that letting the tax cuts lapse would cut into a budget that includes a gardener, housekeeper, and nanny, two cars, $60,000 a year in retirement savings, and $60,000 for private school. We are just getting by, he wrote. The blogosphere cried foul, but what's really at work here is whether someone feels rich. Here's another piece of our conversation with Ted Klontz and, starting off, Robert Frank.
There's this generational issue where being wealthy used to mean that you lived off the income from your capital, that you didn't have to work, and that wealth gave you the freedom to do what you really loved doing rather than just working for money. What changed in the late 1980s, 1990s, and really ramped up in the 2000s was the consumption side of that. So being rich used to mean you could live a modest and fine lifestyle off your capital. With this arms race of conspicuous consumption where houses and mansions got to be twice as large as they used to be, yachts got to be three times their average size, luxury became this enormous industry where everyone, both the aspirational and the truly wealthy, were spending, spending, spending. The definition shifted from living modestly off your capital to having tons of stuff.
Do you think that changes coming out of the economic collapse and the recession?
I think everyone expected it to change because the wealthy took a huge hit in their wealth, and it did change probably for about a year. But what we're starting to see now, just in the last few months, with the stock market rebound and capital markets coming back, is that the wealthy are spending on luxuries again. And I think we're going to see a back to the future here where wealth and being rich is really defined on the luxury consumer and who has the bigger house. And it might shift a little bit away from the Hummer and back toward the Prius. But I do think that the wealthy love to show their wealth. America is still an achievement-oriented society. And I think that it will still largely be wealth defined by consumption as opposed to just living modestly off your capital.
I don't believe that they see themselves that way. I think that the words they would use is, we're really lucky, we're really fortunate, we don't have to worry about some of the other things. But I think words like rich and wealthy are really ways that people who look at people who seem to have a lot or have a lot of capability to get a lot, it's more of an external label that we hang on people.
It's true. It becomes a four-letter word. In my book, Richistan, I profiled about a dozen people or so with net worths of $10 million or more. I had a couple, they're worth about $200 million. They said to me, wow, I love reading that book about those people. I couldn't believe those kind of, you know, those people in your book. And mm-hmm. So the wealthy loved the book, and it was mainly because, as Ted points out, they don't see themselves as wealthy. There's another component to that, which is that Americans always look up when they're defining wealth. So they never feel like the top guy. You know, even someone like Larry Ellison sort of looks at Bill Gates and wonders, what's it like to be Bill Gates? Mm-hmm. When they do these Gallup polls and they poll people and say, what's it take to be rich? Most people take their current income or current wealth and double it because that's the most amount that they can sort of realistically imagine having. There was a billionaire I talked to who said, I'm not rich. Now, let me tell you about this guy I know who is rich. We're always looking at those above us and comparing ourselves to the people that we'd like to be rather than looking down at the reality.
But from either end, isn't there a level of absurdity to saying that if you have $1 million, $5 million, $200 million, a couple of billion, that you're not wealthy? It's delusional.
Some of it's PR because, you know, you want to seem humble no matter how much you have because that's the American way. But the larger point there, which I think is an honest one for most of these wealthy people, is if you can convince yourself and you are convinced that you are not rich, you are not wealthy, you're absolving yourself of the responsibilities that come with wealth. You know, John Rockefeller Jr. talked a lot about with great privilege comes great responsibility. And he really built the Rockefeller philanthropy engine that drives so much good work today. And I think if you're a self-made rich guy and you say, well, I'm not wealthy, the guy down the street is, then philanthropy, giving to community, treating your workers well, all the responsibilities that come with wealth sort of don't fall off your shoulders, and you can just say, well, when I get there, that's when I'll be responsible. And it's a serious issue that a lot of today's wealthy don't perceive themselves as wealthy.
James Sorwicki argues that a big part of the problem with this whole debate is that there aren't enough tax brackets. In 1970, there were 25. Today, there are only 6. And that means that wildly disparate incomes are lumped together, especially at the top. Sorwicki is a staff writer at The New Yorker and wrote an article this year headlined, "Soak the Very, Very Rich." I asked him whether $250,000 qualifies.
Well, it's almost like a metaphysical question. I think the easy way to answer that is that it makes you incredibly well off. And in the context of the United States at the moment, yeah, it makes you rich. I mean, it puts you probably within the top 3% of earners in the country. And I think by most standards, most people would consider that well off.
Then how is it metaphysical?
Well, because obviously, I mean, the definition of rich changes depending on where you are. I mean, by the standards of most of the world, just about every American is rich. So there is a kind of question of where do you draw the line? I mean, is someone who's, you know, in the top 10% rich? Is someone in the top 15% rich? It's hard to say. But I think that, you know, the 250,000 number, it'd be hard to argue that those people are not doing incredibly well by the standards of just about everyone in the world.
Then why do you think there's so much debate about it? I mean, top 2%, it's pretty easy. You're really well off.
I think the real reason there's a debate is that although people who earn, you know, let's say $250,000, $300,000, have done very well relative to most Americans, they have not done anywhere near as well as people above them. If you look at the incredible rise in incomes at the top of the income spectrum, the vast majority of those gains have gone to the top 1%. And it actually is even more stark than that. They really have gone to the top, you know, 0.1%. So what you've actually seen is this curious phenomenon where while the gap between people who earn $250,000 and ordinary Americans has widened, the gap between the people earning $250,000 or $300,000 and the people above them has widened much more. They don't feel well off, basically.
And you have a great example in the article that you wrote where you say that LeBron James and LeBron James's dentist are paying the same tax rate.
Right. So they're paying the same marginal rate. So every additional dollar that LeBron James makes, he pays the same marginal tax rate as his dentist does.
Right.
Now, the point, though, I think, is not necessarily to say that the people earning $250,000 should, you know, not have their taxes hiked a little. It's odd that we don't have more tax brackets. In other words, it's odd that someone who makes $5 or $6 million a year is paying the same marginal rate as someone who makes, you know, $250,000, $300,000 a year.
I want to take you back to a word that you mentioned earlier, which is this notion of perception, and that a lot of people, even when they're making $250,000 a year, don't feel rich. Should that be a factor? I mean, does it really matter whether you feel rich when you pretty much categorically are?
It shouldn't make a difference in terms of public policy or anything along those lines. But I think it clearly affects the way people react. One of the consequences of this widening gap is that, you know, you have this kind of strange phenomenon where you have people who, you know, may very well have gone to college together, perhaps live in the same neighborhood, who really have radically different experiences of the world. And I think the reality of the way human beings think about money and status is that people tend to compare themselves to their peer groups. They don't tend to compare themselves to, you know, everyone else in the country or in the world. It's a total disconnect. I mean, people don't understand how well off they are, but they don't understand it because that's not their experience of the world.
Is that uniquely American, the aspirational idea that we are comparing ourselves to something that's completely unrealistic?
Well, I mean, I think the reason people feel this way is that it doesn't seem unrealistic, right? Because people who are very much like them, people who, again, they went to college with, who do not have more education, do not seem any smarter, do not work any harder or the like, but who happen to work on Wall Street, let's say, or, you know, happen to be a partner in a law firm or whatever it is, those people are earning 6, 7, 10, 15 times as much. So it doesn't seem unrealistic exactly. It just seems like arbitrary. Hmm. You know, I took this path, you took that path. But I don't think the phenomenon of comparing yourself to your peers is quintessentially American. I think it's pretty universal. But I do think America, because of the American mythology of upward mobility, the American dream, and because we live in an incredibly and intensely consumerist society, that I think kind of magnifies people's sense that they need to basically keep working to get ahead and that they never really have enough.
James Surowiecki of The New Yorker magazine. His most recent book is The Wisdom of Crowds. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and this week we are reprising a special hour about what it means to be rich.
What are the traits of someone who's wealthy? I said, like, spends money, has money.
Stable lifestyle, able to take care of everything he has to take care of.
Someone who thinks that they're better than somebody else. Some care of themselves as arrogant or conceited.
Traits of somebody who's wealthy, I guess you'd have to define wealth. Is it, are you talking just money, or is it more than that?
The ability to think outside the box.
Someone who doesn't have to worry about money.
Their kids go to affluent schools.
Expensive cars, jewelry, and a not caring attitude.
Someone has good personality and knows how to treat people well.
Hardworking, go get it.
I think wealthy people today are very selfish and greedy.
Tend to be very self-motivated and driven.
Somebody that's wise. Someone who is powerful.
Independent and is in control of their life. Non-financial side, happiness.
They can not worry about bills so that they're not maxing out their credit cards in order to buy simple things like clothes and food.
What makes you think I know anything about people who are wealthy? I don't know anyone who's wealthy.
In England, if you're born rich and privileged, you'll probably stay that way forever. And if you're born poor, you'll probably stay that way, too.
Commentator and Reuters blogger Felix Salmon.
Americans, by contrast, believe in the American dream, the idea that anybody can become rich or become president. The two countries' income taxes reflect the differences. The UK has a progressive income tax, which reaches 50% on incomes more than £150,000, which is roughly the same as $250,000. In the US, by contrast, the federal income tax is always less than 40%, no matter how much money you make. Part of the reason is tied up in American aspirations, which were tweaked in a recent New Yorker cartoon. Two guys were in a bar, the first says to the second, "As a potential lottery winner, I totally support tax cuts for the wealthy." Potential wealth. That's why Americans don't like high taxes on the rich, and that's the difference between the US and the UK. The U.S. is a fundamentally aspirational society where financiers like Donald Trump have an enormous and genuine popular following, mostly just because they're rich. Yes, we have wealthy families and celebrities and entrepreneurs and real estate moguls in the U.K. But Brits tend to react to seven-figure incomes with disgust rather than with awe or respect, and they're not under any delusion that they will be wealthy one day. And in that respect, the Brits are much more realistic than the Americans. For all that the American dream is woven into this country's culture, there's actually less social mobility here than in most of Europe. If you're born poor, you're much more likely to make it rich in a country like Sweden or even Canada than you are in the US. Countries that provide good resources for poorer families and have cheap or free university education are much more likely than America to see people working their way up the ladder. Americans oppose tax cuts because they think that even if they're not rich today, they might be tomorrow. But they're wrong about that. The American dream is just a dream. It's not based in reality.
We'll be right back.
So as we've noted, wealth is as much about perception as it is about reality. There are only so many ways you can judge how you're doing money-wise. You can look around at the people you know. Are you doing better? Are you doing worse? But in our mass media age, you can also compare yourself to the standards set by popular culture.
Most people in America are not filthy rich.
Robert Thompson is the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse.
They've heard of Bill Gates, and they know about Oprah, and they see them in the media, but very few Americans actually even know anybody is that rich. So, in many ways, anything we know about the very, very rich must have come from the movies, television, novels, and the newspapers.
Even the phrase "keeping up with the Joneses" originated with a comic strip in the New York Globe in 1913. 2 years later, it appeared in theaters as a silent animation film, an early dose of pop culture's take on wealth, whose descendants have filled the airwaves ever since.
Our culture is almost a catalog of the things that we want to desire. We get it right in the silent era. All those Chaplin films, for example, where Chaplin's little tramp was the poor guy, but he was constantly finding himself in these worlds of opulent consumption. And then, of course, by the end of the film, he'd be eating his own shoe.
But even more than the movies, television brought wealth as entertainment into every American's living room. As early as the mid-1950s, a hit TV series revolved around a millionaire giving away money to people he'd never met.
My name is Michael Anthony. Until his death a few years ago, I was executive secretary to the fabulously wealthy John Beresford Tipton.
Mass media millionaires since then have been, well, a dime a dozen. From Mr. Potter and Scrooge to J.R. Ewing and Mr. Burns. And, of course, the Clampets.
The Beverly Hillbillies!
When we didn't have all this exposure to what wealth looked like, we were relatively happy and, you know, didn't have so much striving for.
Ted Klontz, our Tennessee wealth counselor.
I remember watching Queen for a Day and wishing my mother would get the washing machine, thinking that somehow that would make her happier.
You know something, there just isn't any better way to put it than, would you like to be queen for a day?
In the 1970s, TV developed a bit of a split personality. Middle-class everyman Archie Bunker, on the one hand.
What is this shit? S.S. Pierce, fancy cashews. What, are we getting too classy for peanuts?
The Jeffersons, on the other.
Wheezy, honey, I know how you would hate me inviting people to dinner at the last minute.
Then into the opulent 80s. And what Thompson calls the magnum opus of ostentatious displays of wealth.
With champagne wishes and caviar dreams.
Robin Leach's Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous kept good company with the likes of Dallas and Falconcrest. And even the so-called middle class, says Thompson, had a lifestyle that was out of reach for most in that population. Think the Cosbys.
One more chance. Here is your turkey carving practice.
Or the Keatons.
Just go on outside, okay?
Don't humor me, Alex.
All living in homes many Americans could only dream of. A trend that continued into the classic sitcoms of the 90s.
When we look at how we present ourselves in the culture as just normal people. So if you're looking at a TV show, which isn't about rich people, they're not especially poor, you know, the sitcoms, they're kind of just plain folks. And you look at how those people live, like in Friends, like in Seinfeld, we realize that we've kind of raised the bar of what it takes just to be, you know, kind of happy.
Oh, my God, what happened? I got a job at Ralph Lauren.
Well, that's great. Congratulations.
Thompson says there are exceptions to that rule, most notably Roseanne.
What's going on with you?
Mother, this is very important. Our school's having a food drive for poor people.
Well, tell them to drive some of that food over here.
But for the most part, middle class on TV is not middle class.
American popular culture does set a standard of living, not among characters that are rich, but among characters that are supposedly just like us, that is a lot higher than a lot of people could ever afford to maintain.
Of course, today, so-called reality TV sets the standard for images of the moneyed elite. Wall Street Journal wealth columnist Robert Frank.
What's happened now, a lot of these reality shows, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, you see the shift from fantasy and aspiration in the 80s to a sense of schadenfreude that they're being humiliated in some way.
So I'm talking to Robin Anton. She created the Pussycat Dolls. So I have to show her the gift I got from Mom and Bruce, a stripper pole.
We've taken a slightly, I think, darker view of wealth in popular culture and the media, looking not just for all the stuff and the trappings of wealth, but also a sense that I may not be wealthy, but I'm happier than Kim Kardashian or Paris Hilton or the girls on Gossip Girl. And that makes us feel better about ourselves. XOXO,
Gossip Girl. Of course, not everyone sees it that way. As commentator Felix Salmon pointed out earlier, wealth generally inspires more awe than disgust in this country. Plenty of young men and women are striving for the lifestyle they see on these shows. Seems not much has changed from Keeping Up with the Joneses to Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And some final thoughts now from Robert Frank and Ted Klontz. The Bush tax cuts were originally enacted in 2001 and 2003, years before the onset of the Great Recession. Since then, just about everyone's notions of wealth have been upended. But to what extent? Ted Klontz starts us off.
The more money you have, the more quickly you understand it can go away in one afternoon on the stock market. And so that's another huge insecurity that at least the folks I work with, a lot of anxiety. It's like, look, it's only in a computer that I've got this. If something happens, I could be penniless tomorrow. And that, thinking that they can get security if they have more works. I know of a lady who just bought 350 pounds worth of gold and had it delivered to her house, and the people go, what am I supposed to do with this?
Wealth used to be about comfort and stability first and foremost, that you didn't have to worry about money. What's changed about wealth creation and investing is that nothing is secure anymore. As we learned, most millionaires in America lost at least 30% of their fortune during this great crisis. And yes, some of them have made a portion of that back. But the lesson was is that wealth is no longer about stability. And I think going forward, we're going to have a much more anxious class of wealth, and also maybe the rest of us saying, well, you know, stability is something I can get from other things in life rather than just wealth.
Yeah, but losing 30% off multi-millions, you know, someone who lost 30% off 100,000 is going to look at that and say, oh, gee, too bad. You know, I really wonder, you know, when you look at the perception of folks who are below the $250,000 mark, and they look at folks who do make that, who are complaining and saying, I am not rich, I am actually middle class. Talk to me about, you know, what that means for people who are making 40, 50, 60.
Well, what's happened in the economy is that the wealthy have become more removed from the rest of the world and the rest of the country, both financially, psychologically, and culturally. So you have this huge disconnect between the world of the wealthy and the rest of America, where the world of the wealthy, compared to the rest of the country, is wealthy, but they don't feel it, they don't feel they're living it, and they don't feel that they're ever going to get there because, again, their whole economics is different from the rest of the country's.
And finally, this holiday weekend, safe to say you'd have to be rich, or at least very well off, to afford the items in something called the CPI, the Christmas Price Index. Every year, the firm PNC Wealth Management calculates the actual cost to buy a partridge in a pear tree, two turtle doves, and the like. It's a bit of holiday shtick. So last year, reporter Sean Cole went deeper into the story. We loved his story so much, we decided to re-gift it to you this year.
Here's my problem. How do you put one universal price tag on, say, five golden rings? Surely it would depend on where you bought them and what carat we're talking about. And that's just the most obvious example.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me a partridge in a pear tree.
All right, calling McFarlane Pheasants in Janesville, Wisconsin. They sell game birds. Char DeBru is the person in charge of mature bird sales.
Hello, this is Char.
And a really good sport.
Okay, you want to know what a partridge in a pear tree would cost?
Two things here. PNC's Christmas Price Index just says partridge, generically partridge, and that they cost $10 a pop this year. Whereas at McFarlane Pheasants,
the price on Hungarian partridge is 13 and a quarter each. but we actually sell two different types of partridge here.
Oh, what's the other kind?
The other kind is the Chukar Redleg partridge. It's a crossbreed.
And do they cost the same?
No, Chukar Redlegs is $11 each, and that price is good through November.
See what I mean? And never mind that you can't even buy a single partridge from McFarlane unless you pick it up yourself. Pear trees get even more complicated.
Well, it really depends on the size.
And the variety. This is Shannon Passmore, by the way, a customer service manager at Willis Nursery in Berlin, Georgia.
They start at $9.95 for a 3 to 4 foot tree.
Would that be sufficient to support a partridge?
Probably not. But if we stepped up to, say, the 6 to 7 foot size,
mm-hmm.
that would be large enough to support a partridge, and it's $54.95.
PNC's estimate? $149.99. And they call themselves wealth managers. With the turtle doves, we were a lot closer. I have them at $25 a piece. The Christmas price index says $56 for the pair. French hens, or mottled Houdan hens, again, depends where you go. I found them for $3.50 a piece on one website, but you have to buy 15 of them. PNC's index says three hens will run you $45. Four calling birds, interpreted by some as canaries. The Christmas price index and I are in sync to the penny on this one. $599.96. And now, the rings.
Back in the day, I think five golden rings actually referred to golden ring pheasant.
What?
That's our understanding of it. That's correct.
This is Scott Soares, Commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Agricultural Resources. He says fully eight of the gifts in the 12 days of Christmas fall under his jurisdiction, or that of his sister agency, the Department of Fish and Game, the six geese.
If you look at what it takes to get a laying goose, then you actually need to have the pair. So to get six pairs, you'd be paying anywhere from $240 to $600 for those laying geese.
And you would need permits for the seven swans, and that costs money. The Christmas price index takes none of this into account. Plus, PNC assumes that the eight maids of milking would each earn a minimum wage, which is in no way true.
We're looking at about $18 per hour for one milk person to currently milk one cow.
I had to call PNC and present them with my findings. Jim Dunnigan is the point person for the Christmas price index, and I really thought I'd be able to trip him up. I mean, even just to start at the beginning with the partridge and the pear tree, were you talking about a Hungarian partridge or a Chukar Redleg partridge?
I believe the Chukar.
Oh, yeah?
If I'm not mistaken.
Turns out he's a lot more up to speed on all this than I thought. He knew about the five golden ringed pheasants?
That's correct.
All of it. And the reason that they list one universal price for each of the gifts, he says, is that they poll the same set of vendors each year. The National Aviary, a Philadelphia dance company called Philadenko. So it's really an apples-to-apples comparison. But he did concede my point, that the cost of some of these gifts depends on how you shop. Especially when I suggested hiring nine lady students dancing instead of professionals.
Well, maybe we'll have to think about a Christmas price index skinnied up a little bit.
A discount index.
Yeah, I'd say there's two ways to do this. More than one way to deliver true love.
And just to finish out the song, Dunnigan says the 10 leaping lords in the index are just guys who play lords in the Nutcracker. The prices for pipers and drummers come from the Musicians Union. Though a fairly prominent drummer told me that not too many of his ilk work for scale. Could I ask you to play something? That'd be great. His name's John Ramsey, and he's performed with the likes of Art Blakey and Wynton Marsalis.
You ready?
Yeah. In Boston, John is just one drummer. It's 12 drummers drumming, you know, we need more drummers. There we go. This is the Senegalese drum ensemble Rambach at MIT. Actually, there was 14 of them. And yes, they played for me for free. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Post your thoughts about what is rich on our Facebook page or at marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. Very happy holidays to you, and we'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering strategies for investors seeking both returns and lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return. American Public Media.